Welcome to the Mug Meeting Summaries podcast. I'm Gilbert Detilieu. Our December meeting was mostly a social gathering, where members mingled and sampled holiday snacks. We also collected a large box of canned goods and packaged goods for Winnipeg Harvest, as well as raising $50 for them in an auction. The meeting started with the usual roundtable discussion, which we join in progress.
Linux or not?
What version of Mac OS?
I think it's fine.
So the Samba share's on the Linux box?
It's on an OS X box.
So the Linux is trying to connect to OS X?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, it's
the other way around, I got your problem.
Yeah, it's likely that, yeah.
Try using the IPv4 address, see if that makes any difference.
I'll give it a shot.
Because, yeah, both of those boxes are IPv6 boxes. Even if you've got nothing explicitly configured, they're talking IPv6 to each other.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
They're on the same subnet, right?
Because the things I looked at, yeah. They're both trying to connect. I mean, Basically, I'm surprised that this is still an issue. Like, is it a security? Why does that not work? Because the emails I saw, like the forum posts that were all from like a year or two ago.
Because Samba doesn't automatically listen on V6. It's most likely. Well,
how about the Samba code in Ubuntu isn't V6 clean yet either? And remember, from the presentation, was it last month, 2 months ago?
Last month.
And then prior, anywhere anybody used an INET ADDR structure in the code, boom, instant V6 breakage.
I just wrote some.
Bad boy.
Yeah, well.
Yeah, there's a lot of stuff just won't quite work right in V6. My favorite was an example in VSDCAN where the guy actually showed us the code on screen. And the code was written for V6. The code to throw the error message in case of some other problem wasn't V6 clean. So it was actually segfaulting in the error logging code. Yeah. So it took him a few days to track that one down.
Another quick one to try, just in case you're bit by the same thing, which works the other way. Change the password to be numeric only and try it again.
Okay.
There was some issues between Snow and a lot of Linux boxes in Samba that will not work. I have the original version of the DNS-232 box,
okay.
A NAS box.
Okay.
All of my passwords on that box, when I'm connecting from Snow and up, have to be numeric. It will not take alpha. It's
okay,
not for lowercase. It's not for lowercase thing in Samba.
Okay. Uppercase, lowercase in Samba?
It's as an uppercase, lowercase collision problem. I don't know what it is.
Oh.
But that's a config option.
It doesn't seem to matter. If you use a numeric password, life is good. If you try any characters or any alpha, it does not work.
All right.
So there's a quick one to try, because that'll take you 90 seconds to try.
Yeah, right, exactly.
If it fixes the problem, then you're bitten by that same issue between Linux and Snow.
Okay, I'll give both a shot.
Yeah, yeah.
And it's a lot easier to fix than the V6 problem.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I think it should be okay, because we need to specify, the IPv4 address, and hopefully that works out. But, yeah. Cool. Okay.
Okay, I'll just throw a quick one out there. For an EXT4 file system, what is the default A time thing, like when you mount that volume? Is it A time, strict A time, no A time, rel A time? What are you supposed to expect when you mount an EXT4? Because I've been on Linux class all this week through work, and the guy who is supposedly an expert tried to show us how you could update A time by just doing ls on the file or whatever, accessing the file but not accessing the file and not changing it and not whatever. And of course it didn't update the A time. And he says, oh, it's broken. And I said, oh, well, I don't think so. And he says, oh, it's probably got something to do because Linux is running on in a virtual machine. It's like, no,
you're
pretty sure that would have nothing to do with it. And so he said, oh, I'll have to do some research. It's like, well, and then I did a quick, man mount, I think. And it listed, it's like, when I started seeing these, it's like, oh, yeah, well, strict A time, no A time. And I know about no A time and A time. And it's like, oh, yeah, rel A time. I think rel A time only updates the A time if it's less recent than the M time or C time or something like that. If they're all the same, like then that. It just says I'm not going to bother changing the read time.
Sure.
I don't know.
There's also no DIRA time is one of the options, which I find useful because I still like having the A time updated on certain files, but directories, it's not terribly useful, and that's where you end up with a lot of useless writes, is because anytime you do an LS, it hits the directories. And symlinks, I'm not sure if they're similarly affected by no DIRA time, but it would make sense if it applied to symlinks as well as directories, because it's kind of part of the directory structure.
Because if you look at the mounts, it just says, you know, defaults. It's like, well, what is the default for EXE4? I don't know what the default is.
Isn't it like system-wide, not file system type-wide?
No.
Wouldn't the defaults be the same for EXE3?
Not necessarily.
Not necessarily. But it's a question of whether they are trying to maintain reverse compatibility, in which case they would use A time on by default.
Well, I don't think there's any system that uses no A time as part of the default.
Yeah.
But
it might be rel A time.
Yeah, I've never used that, so
I know there are a lot of people within the Linux development community who would like A time done away with completely, but that's not likely to happen because it is useful for certain applications.
But by default, it's got to be A time or rel A time for him. Can't be no A time. Highly unlikely.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Default should still be just on
ASTU.
Yeah. Like standard A time. Wouldn't that give it to you? Like, unless I'm crazy. Because then it should give you, in the examples, it should give you the default what it uses.
Man mount.ext4.
Yeah. Assuming they've actually documented it.
Yeah. Never know. Okay. Next question.
Linux 12 came out this week, last week. Installed it on a few machines. Compared to Mint 10 and Mint 11, didn't like the GNOME 3 interface all that much. Just ended up with two iPhones on the desktop and, okay, how do I access my programs? You can't. Well, you can, but you got to be really clever.
In a very fruity way.
Yes.
Alt F2.
But the thing is, we can't go around giving out those machines to people who've never used Linux before. But what I found is that instead of going with GNOME 3, go with GNOME Classic under Mint 12, and it's barely acceptable.
It's ironic, because the whole point of GNOME 3 is to make it more accessible to people who've never touched a Linux desktop.
Yes. And it looks so much like the old Windows 3.1 and the old Mac system software, you know, the pre-OS 10 stuff.
That's kind of a move in the wrong direction, isn't it?
Yeah.
That's why all the love for GNOME 3.
So much love for that floating around right now, yeah.
See, I don't know if that would... Like, from my perspective, I like controlling everything, and... Yeah, everything was moved around, so trying to find even the system settings, it's like I have to shut down my computer to, because it's all in that menu on the right, right?
Yeah, exactly.
But I don't know the perspective from a regular computer user if it actually would be easier to find, because they're never looking for that stuff.
Yeah,
so
exactly.
They just, but, yeah.
But on a related note, apparently KDE3 is no longer being maintained, so it's been forked off. And it's now called Trinity 3.whatever. And apparently the guy's doing some development on that. And I've read a couple, not many, but a couple of really good reviews on it.
We'll see.
And now it's when everybody switches to XFCE.
Yeah.
Well, yeah. I mean, I already know people who've switched to XFCE because they couldn't stand the new GNOME interface.
And KDE bloatware.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I will confess, I've actually started using Unity. But because I normally run everything full screen, it works great for me. And because I normally do everything from a keyboard, the fact that all your apps are accessed using the Windows key works great for me.
Except Alt-Tab, if you have multiple terminal windows open, doesn't switch between terminal windows. It switches between the window groups by default. So if you have Firefox and two terminals open, and you're on a terminal, Alt-Tab will give you a Firefox.
It's probably some other...
It's It's going to be a 7.
Sure,
it's stupid defaults. Stupid
defaults. Sure, I think it's some sort of problem.
So maybe.
I have a solution to that. I'm staying at 11 for a while.
Yeah. Well, actually, at home, I'm running mint 10 simply because
I got my wife away from XP to mint, and she's on 10, and I got 12 to look at it, and I went, no. So, mint 11, thank you. She loves it.
Actually, if you go to the new classic, it's not so so bad. But,
I don't want not so bad.
Yeah.
Wait for mint
13. Mm-hmm. Well, it still thinks my desktop's a laptop. All the settings are laptop settings.
Oh.
Like that. Basically, what do you want to do when your cover shuts? where's the cover?
You've got other problems if it on the table.
Yeah.
Does your PC have a case sensor? I had that happen when I bought the case sensor for intrusion. Was it laptop lid? I was like, so when I did something.
Wow,
interesting.
Awesome.
Actually, the last three machines I ran Linux on, just generally, they all thought it was a lap. They all thought they were laptops.
It's a futuristic thing.
Yeah.
What brand of motherboard are you buying anyway?
Let's see. Asus.
Not all the same.
No, I think I had two of those. I had an Intel and a few Dells at the Aboriginal Center also claimed to be laptops.
It's weird.
Yeah.
Very weird.
Could it be that the UI just goes, yeah, we'll give you the 7 even if it doesn't work?
Yeah, that's probable, because I was talking with a number of people on the news groups and they were saying that the folks at Mint and Ubuntu are trying to go for the Microsoft one-size-fits-all approach.
They never learn.
They never do. But apparently,
our competition.
But apparently, Debian, when I tried it, it was smart enough to realize these machines aren't laptops.
Debian still boots on modern hardware, then?
Oh, yes.
Not quite that far behind.
What's that?
K3BSD. Where else can you get that? Get what?
That's just evil. Anybody know anything about what happened to Ubuntu or Canonical's drive to replace X11?
I think they implemented it with, what was it, 10.10?
Yeah, it is implemented.
Oh, really?
By default. It has X11... emulate, like it provides an X11 interface, so you're probably running it on your laptop. You're probably running Wayland, probably, not guaranteed.
Okay.
When I went to 11, the latest one, 11.10, it was there by default. I thought, I was like, I don't know, whatever.
Yeah.
But that was like a couple weeks ago, so it might just be that they updated something.
You figure it out by changing your video card and seeing if your computer still goes.
Pretty hard with a laptop.
But, like, every single problem I've ever had with Linux...
Except Rob's laptop.
...was either, like, me deleting the wrong partition, which is my bad, or swapping out a video card and X11 being like, what I have on config isn't what you have, I'm not going to go into graphical mode. And as a person starting out, I'm like, what happened? Like, I'm 17, and I'm like, oh, Linux, this seems fun. And then, like, a week later, I upgrade my video card, and it's like, it stopped working. I hate X11 so very much for all of the stupid things it does. The fix is to delete x.conf. And when it's deleted, it works.
Yeah.
Oh, bad design! Bad design! So I'm pretty excited that X11 is getting... I think I'm the only one.
Well, okay, if it is running Wayland, then their X11 emulation layer is pretty much perfect, because I haven't noticed. What, 3 versions of Ubuntu, then?
Wow. I could be wrong, but I know in the last one it's at least a default in some configurations. In some configurations. I might have gotten a weird spin, like a different live CD thing.
Yeah,
but
worth checking. And then the next question is, what the hell is going on with Open Printing switching to PDF-based workflow for printing? I just read this on their website the other day, and I'm like, and they claim that Ubuntu's been doing it since 10.04, behind the scenes, transparently. What happened to PostScript?
Wasn't it very similar, PDF versus PostScript?
There are a lot of very close similarities. They came out of the... PDF is sort of a special purpose fork of PostScript, if you will, you know, plus 10 years worth of development. Think GNOME 3. PDF is the GNOME 3 of PostScript. There we go. Actually, that's not too inaccurate a way to describe it, come to think of it. It doesn't have all the algorithmic complexity PostScript does. It's not a full-blown programming language in and of its own right, whereas PostScript is. Oh, yeah, you ask about anybody who's been around long enough, they'll tell you stories about guys who would actually run compute jobs on the printers.
Nice. That's pretty awesome.
Not that anyone like that is sitting in this room.
Processors are processors.
Yeah. Yeah, so PDF can't do that, and it's got a lot of display optimized bits. So they. So they took some of what they did with display PostScript and merged it with PostScript 3 and came out with sort of the bastard child, and it was PDF. More or less.
Doesn't the Mac do that as well?
Well, Mac's had PDF-centric workflow for a while, and I gather that's what's driving it, is because it's all cups, right? Mm. And guess who owns cups? So up until recently, for some value of recently that I can't identify, somebody at Apple was maintaining a set of patches for Linux, and now somebody at Open Printing is maintaining a set of patches and has decided to go the path of least resistance to the Borg. Resistance is futile. You will be assimilated. So I'm just like, what happens when you print PostScript to a PostScript printer now? Mm-hmm. Does it go PostScript to PDF back to PostScript?
You can't program that anyway.
Well, I mean, in some cups setups, right, that's what happened with PostScript, was you went from PostScript to PostScript to PostScript, and it got reinterpreted at least twice along the way. Is that seriously what it's doing? And really, what advantage is this giving me?
It's not a response to Google's Cloud Print, is it, so that they can print from devices like phones and stuff directly over the internet and have a format that's acceptable to all those devices. Because Google's Cloud Print is an interesting animal. I've been looking at it the last few weeks, but you can print from your phone to any designated printer on Google. And I believe that they're doing some sort of PDF conversion that way, and they may be trying to compete with that technology. Because cloud printing is going to be the big deal.
Does that remind me of tax?
It is. So I thought about it when I saw it the first time.
So the dream of IP faxing has finally been realized?
Well, didn't they
20 years late?
Start doing that with their printers a while ago?
So does Brother, yeah, so does Canon, yeah. So does Xerox, yeah. So does, yeah.
Yeah. All in their own little world.
Yeah.
Right, okay. Let's open the barn door so everybody can walk through.
All right, so nobody knows. All
right. Sorry.
Next. Other issues, questions, comments?
Somebody. On the whole printing topic, does anyone use anything other than cups? In this particular scenario, it's going to be narrow printing, if that matters.
What are you printing?
From what are you printing? Is probably the core question.
That's going to be an arch setup. PDFs, you name it, document.
I guess at this point, the question is kind of, why bother? Like, cups is pretty much one, for lack of a better term. Everybody and everything uses cups now. Like, even some of the BSDs use cups by default now. Which seems a gross, I don't know, somehow that's just wrong, but they can do it because CUPS is actually BSD licensed. So.
And most of the Unix printing stuff that I've had to do is from Windows machines, so I pretty much just said use the BSD like straight through and pipe through Samba. That's because I'm mostly in a Windows world. It's probably not going to work the same.
What kind of printers?
HPs.
HPs, I mean, you can port 9100 them. You can actually FTP a lot of, yeah. I had a couple of HPs, the 4000 series. You can FTP PDFs to them, little printer.
That's great. How would you do that automatically?
You have to write the script of channel or do something to do that.
If you've got HP network printers and your clients are Macs, did I just hear you say? Sorry. Are your clients Macs?
No, Linux boxes, Arch Linux.
He actually just print directly to them, but I don't know if the HPs are going to recognize PDF documents. And you'll have to do a wrapper to convert that to PostScript or to PCL or something.
It depends on the model. That's model specific.
Well, oddly enough, I got a 2025, and I just went through the GUI. Said, "Okay, I got a network printer." They said, "Where is it?" I started typing in the IP, and I got halfway through, and says, "Oh, I see it. I'll configure it for you."
Yeah.
So I mean, that's a simple way of doing it.
And what were you doing it on?
Oh, this was on Mint 10, Mac, Mint 11.
I was doing some reading on 4900 with Gen Direct, and I just didn't know if there was a way to actually get it to send it directly to the printer.
Well, you can do it just to the IP address of the printer, just a cap to it.
Yeah.
I've done that, but that's the low level, just plain text and PCL commands.
But generally speaking, in Linux, if you're running a GUI, any sort of desktop environment, any kind of like normal end user type productivity apps, they need a local print spooler subsystem in order to discover the printers that are defined, figure out what its capabilities are, et cetera, et cetera. And at the moment, CUPS is really the only thing that's tightly integrated with the rest of the world. So you don't have to use CUPS as a centralized spooling subsystem. That would actually be pretty useless in your environment unless you had accounting requirements. But if you don't need like page accounting requirements or chargeback for ink or anything like that, then yeah, you just set up each box, each and every box points to its local printer's IP address. It just works. I mean, yeah, CUPS is kind of ugly software, but it just works, despite that. LPR, I mean, if you really have a hate on for CUPS for some reason, go to openprinting.org and read up on all of their how-tos for how to use LPRNG, there's really only one other. There's CUPS, there's LPRNG, and there's a third one whose name I can't remember right now. They're all equally poorly documented.
Yeah, so I found.
I think it was LP.
Yeah, you're right. Somebody re-implemented LP, a la System 5-ish LP, which they should be shot, but that's just my personal opinion. yeah, I don't know. It's 6 months after. It's almost an even draw, right? If you're doing it by hand, they all suck. If you want to use the GUI tools, you have no choice. You must use CUPS.
And the GUI is relatively fast. Crawl rate, this is, I did the same printer on a half dozen machines at my place. Get up on my father's Windows machine. If he wants the CD for the drivers, 3/4 hour later, everything is configured and running.
Yep. Probably want to install 200 megabytes of crap on your machine.
Exactly. Now, please buy our paper. Please buy our software.
Yeah.
And meanwhile, for Mac and Linux, I mean, it took less than 30 seconds.
They installed the bloody driver like it was supposed to.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, originally, I kind of started the idea was, when I tried, I think it was XFCD, I saw that it had like out-of-the-box support for not only CUPS, but what was it, LPR?
LPR or LPRNG, yeah.
That's the thing I'm like, printing system, I'm kind of like, maybe, but maybe if CUPS is the only thing I'll do.
I mean, LPRNG
is... I think CUPS went into several reincarnations, so I might be sort of going out on a limb here, but I think I looked at my Macintosh and it runs CUPS too, so I don't know. It seems to have become sort of like a de facto almost. Well, anyways, sorry.
Anyone here that the new Amazon Kindle Fire. Can be rooted by playing an MP3 file?
What?
You've got to use the right MP3 file.
I have to use the right MP3 file, but
Seriously?
Well, its MP3 player is experimental. And one of the features is some of the optional ID fields or some kind of field aside from the music can contain executable code.
Yep.
So
you can root a Ford Fusion at the same time. You can take over the nav and the.
Oh, I think we bought stuff.
Anyway, I thought that was kind of
how wonderful.
World's easiest route.
And everywhere car thieves are rejoicing.
Play an MP3. Oh, there you go. I love, like, with jailbreaking Wi-Fi touch. This is the website and you can swipe. Right? Because there were so many issues with. There was file types, basically really old vector images or whatever, and they never bothered, WMS, and they never fixed it or whatever. So for this one, because it was jailbreak.ee, and so you just take your iPhone or iPod Touch or any iOS device, you just go there and swipe. Which is worrisome, because they at least give you the option to swipe.
Yeah.
Other web pages could have just been like,
this is the website, boom.
And it's like, let's just read, hide in the background. So I think they had more for iOS 5, because I know 5.01 fixed like 3 or 4 pulls. Because if they'd stop running the browser as root, I'm sure it would be less of an issue. But everything on there is running as root, so they could just run it. But,
let me remind everybody.
Is this an issue for cell phones? Sorry? Like, would this be an issue for Android or other cell phones if you... play something on,
Well, not yet.
not that we know of.
So do they charge you 99 cents for that MP3? Let me just remind everybody that TrueType font files are, in fact, executable files.
Why would people design it that way?
Why would Windows search JPEG files for executable code?
Steve Ballmer did it.
It was actually a response to pressure-friendly font founders. So that they could hint their fonts properly without exposing their proprietary techniques for doing so. So they would simply ship it as an executable kernel, and the TTF engine would run the hinting code.
So typography snobs cost.
You know all that ice cream?
Actually, it wasn't typography snobs, it was typography lawyers.
Yeah. Pretty much. But yeah, OS2, Windows, macOS, all will actually run code embedded in a TTF file.
Is it sandboxed or anything? I mean, I would assume.
Not really, no.
I trust JavaScript.
I just read.
The problem would be that fonts are likely going to run at a pretty high level of privilege or so on.
Yeah,
as of Windows 2000, they ran at Ring Zero. Windows XP, they ran in, I think it was Ring One, because they split out the WDM driver model. In Vista, there is a little bit of protection. All you can crash or root, so to speak, is the video driver, which is bad enough, because from there you can get other attack vectors, but at least it doesn't instantly lock up the entire machine now. And at least, Windows 7 has a watchdog for the video driver, so it will kill it and restart it if necessary. Yeah, because I've got a couple of bad fonts that on a Windows XP or earlier box will lock the box up solid instantly. The instant Windows Explorer looks at the file and tries to build an icon for it, dead. Dead as a doornail.
You sure it won't come back if you wait?
No, not on XP, because XP it's in a tight loop and nothing catches it.
Because if you get a really big install file on XP, like a big EXE, I have no idea why XP searches the entire 4 gigs of this EXE file looking for I don't know what.
Signatures,
fonts, icons, I don't know what the hell it's looking for. But you can just watch it spin through that entire DVD, and the DVD just sits there on light for all 9 minute, 35 minute, 40. Then it comes back like nothing's wrong. Like, did you miss me?
Also, why would somebody create an EXE that big?
Like a zip.
Great.
Yeah.
Spit it into bloody different files.
Yeah.
Well, yeah. That's, they MSI is about the same size, so take your choice.
So, so it only has to be signed once.
Anyone want to bid on the books yet?
Last question before you go. Any CentOS users?
Sort of.
Yeah.
Five, six?
Five.
CentOS 5, Scientific Linux 6.
I'm looking to put a server in with it. Secure, not secure, it's going to be on the real world. Later than 6, 5?
Doesn't matter, it's IP tables.
Okay.
Yeah.
So I can roll up my sleeves and lock it down.
If you're doing it now, I would go with version 6.1. CentOS just came out with version 6.1. Scientific Linux has had it out for a few months already.
Is there a VMware image yet?
I don't know.
Okay. I'll check the
Alan, if you want secure server out of the box, why are you installing Linux?
That too.
Because I have two options. If I'm going to VPS, virtual private server, my two options are Windows or CentOS. And so, it's like the seven-headed Hydra, two-headed dragon. You take the two heads, and I work at it hard enough.
It's quite easy to secure enterprise Linux.
It's mostly going to be web server, and web and email is all I'm doing. All I'm exposing to the outside world, so scratching your heads.
It comes with SE Linux enabled by default, which is both good and bad. I mean, from a security perspective, it's good. Mm-hmm. From a configuration perspective, it's a pain.
But once I get the
web server
set, I can then pull the VM image as a backup.
Run CGIs, it's a pain.
If anything goes wrong, I can go back to that state in minutes.
I can't speak to CentOS 6, but on any EL5 based system, you can't really uninstall much of the minimal install. Like, a minimal install gives you about five times as much crap as you need. Most of you have to leave there or you start breaking RPM dependencies. Mm-hmm. What you do need to do is go through checkconfig.cache/list and shut off 99% of it.
Yep.
Like, instantly.
Turn port mapper off?
Among other things, yes. And, you know, you probably don't need SmartD running in a VPS.
Nope.
Stuff like that.
Yeah. So basically go in and round up the usual suspects and kill them.
Yeah.
And set up IP tables. That way you're only exposing whatever ports you need.
You run setup. Yeah.
Literally.
Setup. That's the first one, yeah.
That's the front end menu screen, and one of the options in it is firewall. But as of 5.6, I don't know if they fixed it in 6 or not, you couldn't run the tool if you had disabled SE Linux.
I went in to disable SE Linux. So.
Yeah, exactly. But it's like buried in the security tool. So if you've disabled security, they figure, you must not want any security. Well, beyond the traditional, you know, don't listen on that port. If you don't want to answer on that port. I don't know, on a public web server, I don't even bother with IP tables. I just make sure that Apache is the only thing listening to any port on any interface.
Yeah, maybe turn off all the other stuff. The only things I need on there are POP, SMTP, web server, and SSH.
Just make sure you install fail to ban or run SSH on a port.
Or both.
It'll just carry those things.
Yeah. Yeah, fail to ban is basically anti-port knocking.
Mm-hmm.
Just move SSH to a different port. Mm-hmm. Otherwise, LogWatch will give you about a 20 megabyte email every day.
Yeah,
or set up some IP tables rules to get rid of that. I wrote an article on it in one of the mug newsletters a couple years back.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. It's in the archive.
Well, you can set up SSH to pre-share the keys and then ignore everybody else.
Mm-hmm. You do that too.
I got fixed IP at my house, so I can probably lock into that too. It means if I ever get an IP address change, I'm going to drive across town and plug in.
Who's your provider? Who's your provider for your static?
I've been moving right now, so he's going from Bell to West Cheeky, who got bought by Bell, who screwed everything up. So I think he's going with Shaw now.
Who's your VPS
Epic?
If it's in town?
Hmm?
You said
the Epic.
You were running a VPS.
Yeah, it's a data center out on.
I guess, I think. What company?
Not a company? SWD. St. James Street.
Oh, the guy way up north on St. James Street?
They're just moving there because he needs to go to the next stage of bandwidth, and that's not Bell's most economical tool, so he's got to change to a new provider.
Yeah, well, in Winnipeg, that means he's going big pipe.
Well, I mean, he's collapsing into one, and pretty soon it'll be all roads lead to either Jim Shaw or Pierre Brulin, so.
Pretty close. Actually, it's kind of funny that MTS Allstream has some of the best bandwidth across Canada, and we can't get to it here in Manitoba.
Well, that's because MTS is in the process of hiving Allstream back off again. Sorry, folks. I'm just the messenger.
Mm-hmm. Whatever.
Sounds like a good department.
Don't get me started.
That's it for this podcast. Thanks for listening. For more Mug Meeting summaries, or for more information about the Manitoba Unix User Group, check out our website at muug.mb.ca.